Hi, everyone. Welcome to Embracing Change, where we explore how changes in technology and consumer behavior are affecting businesses across industries. I am your host, Gerardo Kerik, and today we're talking about how digital transformation is transforming the world of education. My guest today is Tamás Hyman, co-founder of Supercharger Ventures, the world's first online cross-border edtech accelerator. Previous to this, he worked with one of Europe's largest banks, and is currently board member at the European EdTech Alliance. Tamás, welcome. How are you?
I'm very well. Thank you. Great to thanks for having me.
Oh, thank you for being here. So Tamás, I know you're based out in London, right?
That's correct.
How's everyone feeling in London?
Very mild. I have to say it's been a very mild autumn. So far, so good this year.
So far, so good this year. And is it a little bit warmer because of how the English national team is doing at the World Cup?
That made the temperature much higher yesterday.
That's awesome. And Tamás, just for the benefit of our audience, I'd like you to do a quick introduction on yourself. Would you mind?
Absolutely. So I'm Tamás. I'm Tamás Hyman. My background is actually in finance and banking. I've been on the capital markets, on the trading floor for 20 years, and moved to EdTech 5 years ago, never looked back. I really enjoy the space. It's a great sector to be in. As you can imagine, it's very different from investment banking and finance.
Yeah, of course. I've
spent most of my career in structured products. So I started in the Chicago Board of Trade, on the trading floor, on the open outcry, and then worked in Barclays, Citi, Gen, all the major banks, and selling and structuring derivative products.
Wow. And you're originally from Hungary, right?
I'm from Hungary. Went to school in France and Spain. Mm-hmm. Worked in the UK, in Vienna, in Zurich, and lived in LA. So I'm quite international and a big champion of Europe.
Fantastic. So Tamás, I know you you fell in love with EdTech, right? What is EdTech, in your opinion?
Yeah, good question. So we look at EdTech as a very broad definition. So we look at EdTech as from early childhood to adult learning. So we include any solutions, and it doesn't have to be deep tech. So it sometimes it's more the user experience, but any solutions, tech solutions helping education from early childhood to professional and corporate learning.
Mm-hmm. So it's not limited to schooling or universities.
No, absolutely not. And if you think of it, one of the main themes in education today is that when kids start going to school, the schools need to prepare them for jobs that don't exist today, and lifelong learning is the new learning, right? So EdTech, therefore, is not limited to kids and schools. EdTech is for the whole spectrum of learning, and including lifelong learning, including professional learning.
Of course. So I remember when we were doing our prep call, you said something that I found really, really interesting, and I would love to try to pick it up again for our audience here, which is about the fact that you coming from a finance background and having seen how the finance industry totally transformed digitally, and you think there's a lot of parallels between what happened with the finance industry and what's going to happen with the educational world. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Yes, of course. And I come from banking, and when I left banking, I was kind of thinking what's next, and started to look at fintech, and ended up helping startups focusing on educating finance professionals on the impact of technology in finance, right? So what AI does to finance, what are the new trends, what are the new techs? And when COVID started, we sat down with our co-founders and we thought there is a huge parallel in what's happening to ed tech to what happened to finance and fintech during the financial crisis. In 2008, 2009, the banks were so focused on cleaning the balance sheet, surviving, and dealing with the crisis, that it gave an opportunity for many startups and to take a small piece of finance, make it faster, cheaper, better, or approach a financial problem from a very different angle. And while the banks were not focusing on that, really grow the user base on those. So examples would be, you know, most people in the UK, but across Europe, know Revolut, which is a challenger bank, or another very good example would be credit scoring, alternative credit scoring, which, just to name one in the US, one big one in the US called Cabbage, approaching mid caps credit scoring from a very, very different angle compared to what traditional banks would do. And once you get this cheaper, faster, better with a single product, and we call it unbundling on finance, unbundling and rebundling of finance. So you take a small piece, which, you know, the example of Revolut, you take not even credit cards, but just a debit card, right? And you make it look cool, and then you put an app on top of it, which is super user friendly. And based on that, you build millions of users. Mm-hmm. And once you've got a millions of users, then you start rebundling. You put back FX, you put back rates, you back deposits, start to put back credit. So that concept, we see also an opportunity in education. And mm-hmm. and of course, you've got some which are known, like Coursera or BBC Maestro, which is a new initiative. But so you take a small piece of education, mm-hmm. you focus on either micro learning or some very specific sectors. And once you've built a user base, then you start, some of them start building a university on top of that, and you start building mm-hmm. an online university. So that's one example.
Yeah. So it's interesting, this concept of the unbundling of mm-hmm. services, and then the rebundling once yep. you acquire it's almost like in sales there is a probably you've heard this before, there is a term called the monkey's paw, right? Have you heard about the monkey's paw? The monkey's paw is an offering that opens the door. You know, you capture a client that way, and then after you you're already selling to that client, you grow your business from there. And it's called the monkey's paw because the way in Africa, the way some of the hunters are able to catch monkeys is they throw them in a bag of nuts, right? That it's tied up on a rope, right?
Yes. Yeah, I remember seeing that.
Exactly. So they throw that to them and the monkeys really want that back, right? So they're holding on that back and then they're slowly pulling them to them and the monkeys, they never let that back go because they really want it. Right. So to me, it sounds a little bit similar to that because that doing something cheaper, faster, better, people are getting in because of that reason. And then once you are in a relationship with them and engaging with them, you can start selling them other services around it. Right.
Yeah. And then it is true for commercially, but I guess the reason it's even more valid in education is because things are changing. Right. Mm-hmm. And the model of you go to school, you do your BA, then you go 2 years to a bank, do your as an analyst, you work for 2 years, then you go back, you do your MBA, and then you go back and then become an associate VP. that's for the past. That's mm-hmm. for that's going to be a niche career path. What we think is that, first of all, things change. Honestly, what I've learned, I'm not super young anymore, but what I learned at university is most of it is completely useless. And even when I left banking, most of what I learned in the top school for derivatives and structured products, by even 5 years, 10 years after, we were absolutely useless because mm-hmm. things change so fast. Mm-hmm. So in fact, micro learning, micro credentials, and continuous learning, we see that as a huge trend for the future.
Of course.
Then of course, the moment you said that, then the next big theme is, okay, if you do micro learning, then how do you accreditate then? What's going to be your diploma, right? If you just mm-hmm. did a 1 week course on something, which is super specific, mm-hmm. how will people recognize that you've done that? And in a little bit, you can already see this. When people put on LinkedIn that I've done this 1 year, 1 week course here, you put the logo, I've done another course there. And if you did that 10 years ago, no one cared. Now it's actually, people do accept it as okay.
Yeah, actually, one of the trends that we've seen with the big resignation in COVID, right, is that a lot of people that were working without college education, right, in service industries, like waiters or other roles like that, right, haven't gone back because some of the big IT companies have chosen to hire them, right, and train them, invest in them, for 8 months, 9 months, train them. And they're finding very, very good results, right? And they're finding that they can hire talent, train them, and they pay them less than they would have to pay somebody coming out of college, but of course more than they would be making out of a $15 an hour salary, right? So it's a win-win for both of them, and getting very, very good results. And
so what you just said highlights two super important trends, actually. Uh-huh. Number one is, how do you link higher education to the job market?
Yeah.
Right? And what you said is a good example, is clearly a missing link. Mm-hmm. And if these tech companies need to invest 6-8 months in the employees to be employable, then clearly the higher education doesn't do the right job. Right?
Well, because they're hiring people without the higher education, right?
It's still the case even for many people coming from colleges and schools.
True.
Because what they learn is not specific enough for a Microsoft or Google to use them as coders, right? So they need to. But then what you mentioned is that, okay, so you've done your 6-8 months of training at Microsoft or Google, and then you move on to somewhere else. And how do you carry on that training and the certification for the training that you actually can do that specific
task,
coding language tasks, project? And that's what accreditation will, the micro accreditations and accreditations market will do. And quite a few startups are trying to tackle that.
Yeah, and I think what it's interesting is that, yeah, and I'd love to hear your opinion on this, is that some of this micro accreditation is just being done by the companies, right? So if you are, like in my time, right, I came up through marketing, right? And you might not study marketing in college, but if you ended up working at Procter & Gamble, for example, right, or Unilever, and you went through the marketing university at Procter & Gamble or Unilever, that was good enough for you for the rest of your career, right? I mean, anybody would hire you if you spend a few years at those companies for a marketing role, even if you came from engineering, right? Which was my case, for example. Mm-hmm. So I think that's happening now, but more at the macro level, where if you're joining a Google or Microsoft or one of these tech companies, if they're training you, that might be good enough for many others, just knowing that you went through that process, right? And I guess that's a big challenge for formal education, right?
Absolutely. And then if we do the analogy against to finance, the reality is that finance is so specialized that, for example, the area where I was of, emerging markets, interest rates, cross currencies, it's so specific that most people don't even understand what I know and what I don't know. If you look at, he's coming from Barclays, doing on the trading floor, so he must know. But I had no clue on what the euro trader 5 to 10 year part of the curves would do, right?
Yeah.
Of course, I know what they do, but I wouldn't be able to do the job because it's such a specific knowledge. So that again, to your point, people from the outside would say, okay, he's from Barclays, he's from the trading floor. Maybe he can, he can work and do that. But in reality, when you had the real discussions with the real team and headhunters, it became super specific. And that if that credentials, and then of course I get a lot of calls for jobs that are absolutely not relevant, right? Mm-hmm. So if those credentials would be somehow available through micro credentials, then it would make the market super efficient.
Of course. So in your role at Supercharged Ventures, which is an EdTech accelerator, right? And I'd love you to tell me a little bit more about what you guys do and how you work with the, with startups. But in your role, I guess you see a lot of companies trying to tackle those very specific problems, right? The unbundled problems that we talked at the beginning, right? So I guess my question to you would be, what challenges are incumbents facing in competing against these niche, highly specialized edtech startups, right? And what dynamics are you seeing in the marketplace?
Sure. So, first of all, so Supercharger Ventures is as you mentioned, is an accelerator of helping startups scale, grow, build their businesses. Mm-hmm. We help founders save time and get from A to B much quicker, faster, and efficiently. Mm-hmm. through cohorts of 3 to 6 month programs. Again, to the analogy of finance, the reason we started this is not because the world needs another accelerator. There's so many of them, right? Mm-hmm. But what we identified is that the EdTech ecosystem is at such an early stage and such a small and new ecosystem that, in fact, EdTech startup founders, early stage, they really need help with accessing funding, accessing clients, even getting advice on what's the right strategy. So we've done a lot of pre-work before starting, asking startups, do you actually need another accelerator? Do you really need someone EdTech focused? And the answer was absolutely, please do, please start. Mm-hmm. So that's how we started. Now, the question of the challenges they face, I always like to use this for those who studied economy, and if they remember the economics 101, what we call the elasticity of demand. Mm-hmm. Elasticity is demand on how demand reacts to the offer. Mm-hmm. And EdTech is not new. EdTech has been there for 10 years or more. But, sorry. So, EdTech's been there. Mm-hmm. But what's changed is until COVID, most incumbents were really not open to try these solutions. Mm-hmm. The universities, the corporates, they were just not ready to use EdTech solutions. So what changed with COVID is this elasticity of zero impact of you double, triple the solutions. The uptake didn't change. So mm-hmm. the elasticity of demand was zero. That's changed to one. right? Like any new solution, people looked at it.
Mm-hmm.
And then that was a real game changer and the real igniting moment for EdTech. Now, of course, after COVID, you know, this has now gone down. People now look more carefully on what they use, what they try. But we still think that this is just the beginning, right? People understood that these solutions are useful and helpful,
mm-hmm.
and that education is changing and it's never going to go back to the old ways 100%. It's going to be somewhere hybrid.
Mm-hmm.
And the solutions so far, many of them were kind of firefighting. So if you look at, you know, Zoom, Google Meet, of course, they were great tools during COVID. But it's whole ecosystems of solutions will be built on top of these. Mm-hmm. And then back to our point of rebundling, right, in a sense.
Mm-hmm.
Once people get that, okay, fine, so we can actually do some of the courses online, then, okay, how do you measure the engagement of class? Oh, there's an AI solution for that, which is using face recognition.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so now we actually have real-time data on how engaged the class is compared to just everyone sitting there in a classroom, right? So,
mm-hmm.
so that's just, again, one example of how new solutions no one even thought of before COVID are popping up.
Of course, of course. That's fascinating. You know, this whole concept of using AI data and you know, different technology functionality to actually be able to have real data on engagement, yeah. Right?
Imagine you're doing an online class and then some, you know, red lamp popping up on your screen that, you know, hold on a second. Somehow the engagement is really dropping, you know, change what you're doing.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. It's almost like being a DJ, right? In a disco, right? You see people leaving the dance floor, you have to change the song, right?
Yeah.
That's awesome. That's interesting. Very good. So based on that, what new customer behaviors are you seeing? You know, any, of course, we talked about COVID and people getting used to taking classes online, but do you see any new behaviors adopted by customers, by students?
Of course. I mean, of course, plenty. And what I would say is that it's interesting is that higher education and university are the ones that are really getting the most that change is coming. And, you know, mm-hmm. understandably, K to 12, it's still more about being in the class and the teacher, but higher education universities are really getting that things are changing. Interestingly, corporates, not that much yet, right? Mm-hmm. They have their LMS systems. Most of them, you know, spend quite a lot of money on it actually, but the engagement rates are extremely low. Actually, that's okay. one of the first things I learned in EdTech, coming from finance, is the completion rate of online courses, which tends to be around 4%.
Oh, really?
So, yes. Yeah. So it's the real struggle is how to make people use the content that you have.
Hmm.
So I guess one new customer behavior for those that you really understand it is that, okay, fine. So online course has been there for a long time. But how do you, if it's an asynchronous course, which is available online, how do you make people actually complete it full time?
Hmm. Hmm. That's very, very interesting. I didn't have that that data. One of our clients a couple of years back was a group in Mexico called the Aliat Universities, which they built a platform where, you know, they target rural students, right? And they've been acquiring physical universities across Mexico. So I think they have 16 or 17 now. Physical universities, but they created a platform where students that do not live close to a city with a university can actually become an engineer or become, you know, go through the studies all online, right? And you have the option of doing it online or hybrid or fully present in the school, right? Depending of your lifestyle and what you have to do. And what they found is that that opened up a huge opportunity in the marketplace for an audience that had never been targeted, right? I wonder. I would love to go and get back to them because they do manage to follow up with engagement because people have to finish the, you know, the career, right? They have to, you know, to finish, and they have a very, very good success rate. But I wonder if they built a solution for that specific
problem. Yeah, I mean, I guess it's really a bigger issue in the corporates where people are busy with their day jobs. Mm-hmm. I think in universities, yes, people have to finish the course, otherwise, you know.
Okay. Okay.
But it's more of a corporate problem. But to your point, yes, I think it's definitely the future, that hybrid model where you can be online, come in for some times or be there physically. It is the future for sure.
It's almost choosing your own path, right? Choosing your journey.
Yeah. And then last point on this, you know, customer behavior is, of course, as someone put it, is that most of the things being taught are 3D concepts, but are being taught in 2D. You know, let it be architecture, let it be biology, let it be geography. Mm-hmm. And so AR, VR is a huge opportunity, and we see it in as a huge trend and for the future for education.
That's interesting. I never thought about the 2D versus 3D, but it's true. You know, there's some topics that you have to learn 3D, right? Yeah, most of it.
Yeah, most of it. If you think of it, most of it, right?
Yeah, yeah. That very interesting challenge. So, I want to go back to the concept of an accelerator, right? And working with startups, right? When you and I were doing our prep conversation, you said something very, very interesting about your personal insight regarding the cultural response to rejection, right? The fact that as a startup, you have to, when you're fundraising, you're facing rejection constantly.
Yes, yes.
And you talked about a difference in culture between Europe and the US. I'd love if you could to talk a little bit more about that. I found that very interesting.
It's funny you mention it because I gave a keynote speech at Slush last week, and there was an EdTech side event, and I put up two numbers. I'll need to find the exact numbers. I think it was 3,400 with those two numbers, and I asked people, you know, guess what do you think it is? And we were talking about fundraising, we were talking about talking to investors, and it's famously the number of angels and VCs that the founder of Peloton has spoken to before getting the first check. So 3,000 angels and 400 VCs.
Wow.
And yes, you're right. It's a huge difference in Europe, I guess, but even in the US, to be honest, you have this natural instinct that if someone tells you no, then you must be wrong. And, you know, as your parents told you no, then you had to stop something, right? So it's a very human behavior that, especially if like three times people tell you no, then clearly you must be wrong. Mm-hmm. And it just simply does not apply to fundraising, because fundraising is about the numbers, and you never underestimate how much people don't understand what you're saying and what you are building. It's really about vision, and the vision is digital. You see it or you don't. Mm-hmm. And the reality is that to find those investors for an early stage startup that see your vision and share your vision, you need to see more than one or 10 or 15. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And it actually takes often, you know, 100 plus meetings before you get your first check. Of course, mm-hmm. you can get lucky, you can get friends and family, but before you get your first outside check, it would take you 100 meetings.
Wow.
And when I was at the keynote, there was 250 people, startups. I asked them to raise their hands and, you know, who had more than 5 meetings. So everyone who had more than 10 meetings, you know, maybe 80%, who had more than 50 meetings. Then it started to be less than half of the people. Then I said, okay, who had more than 100 meetings? And I think there was maybe 5. Mm-hmm. So I said, good news. You will raise, but you're just not there yet.
Yeah.
But they were very surprised, and they were actually shocked by this number. Mm-hmm. That because it's I think it, I guess you just if you're a first time startup, you just don't know, but this is how it is.
Yeah. Do you see any parallels between that and the role of a salesperson? Because it sounds to me like in sales, it's also a numbers game, right? You know your conversion rates, and you know you have to prospect and call 100 numbers to get 10 meetings, for example.
Absolutely. But and then what's interesting in sales, it's much more a given that yes, you need to, you know, build a funnel, you need to start to speak people, and some will say oh, some will say no, some will say yes. But somehow fundraising is much personal, because it's your own business and it's your own little baby. So if people say no, then you get disappointed. But you're right. It's as simple as that, right? Just like in sales, it's you need to build a funnel. And then to have 100 meetings, obviously, you have to have, you know, 500 emails sent at least.
Yeah, of course. So at what point, because I understand you need to build a funnel and you need to do the prospecting and you need to, you know, have those conversations. But at what point, it's hard. I think it's harder if I put myself in the shoes of an entrepreneur, right? At what point do you attribute your success to the number of calls you've had and your success in raising, right? In raising finance. Mm-hmm. And at what point do you attribute that to maybe having a concept that it's not ready or it's not good enough? How do you draw the line between your behavior, which is basically being in front of hundreds of VCs, angels, and your actual concept?
It's a super hard question. It's a very good question, and it's a very hard question to answer, because again, to the example of Peloton, you know, 400 people told no and 3,000 agents told no, right? Mm-hmm. But mm-hmm. So I think it really depends on how convinced you are and how much you want to spend your time on this, right? Because mm-hmm. one of the key things with founders, one of the things that we test with founders is like, why are you going to spend the next 2, 3, 5 years of your life building mm-hmm. this product, right? And are you mm-hmm. the person to do that? And does it make sense for you to do that? And do you can you convey in the discussions that yes, you are going to do that? Mm-hmm. So if as a founder you convinced, you see it, right? Mm-hmm. Back to the point of vision, you just see it and others don't. Yeah, you might be a lunatic, but just do it.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a good point. So I know you're a very busy man, and we have a hard stop very soon. So I'd like to end our conversation with a personal insight, and I'm gonna tip you off on the personal insight, because we talked about this as well in the past. You talked about the learning curve that you had to go through of being comfortable with not being sure. I would love you to finish off with that.
Sure, that's really interesting actually, because we briefly touched on that. But so I was on the trading floor, right? And the trading floor, the jobs are super specialized. So first of all, you know, back to the example, you don't trade euro rates, you trade the short part of the curve, the middle part of the curve, the long part of the curve. Mm-hmm. They're all very different products. So what I was doing in emerging market rates and currency in trading, it's a very small world, especially in Europe, right? You've got the Russian ruble, Turkish lira, Czech crown, Polish zloty, before the euro. So I knew pretty much everyone in the market, and I knew that what I knew, there was maybe 100 people in the world who knew that. Mm-hmm. And so that's number one. Number two, you deal with huge numbers, right? And you trade 500 million or a billion notional swap, there is no room for error. It's not 99.999, but it has to be 100% checked. Mm-hmm. But you just don't do it. So rule number one, until you check everything, until you're sure, you don't do the trade, right? Mm-hmm. So doesn't matter, how stressed you are, the client is shouting, the trader is shouting, everyone is shouting at you. You just keep calm until you've checked everything, you don't do anything, right? That's mm-hmm. the basic rule. So, fast forward 5 years, you're in a startup. It's really like Wallace and Gromit. You remember that movie when they're on the train and they put the tracks in front of the train. And mm-hmm. going, you probably have seen that, no?
Mm-hmm. Very funny.
So it's nothing is perfect, right? By definition, because you're building a startup, you don't have compliance, you don't have you don't have risk, you don't have nothing. And for me, the first few years, it's been really challenging. I'm saying, okay, why would I succeed, right? Mm-hmm. Because I'm not 100% sure that I'm the best in the market, which I was before, and that I know as much as the market knows, which I knew before. Mm-hmm. So why would I do something? Why would I start something? Why would I be the one succeeding? And then, once you have a vision, you start. But once you start doing something, again, in a startup, execution comes ahead of perfection, right? You get things. I mean, I've learned this concept of small failures, mm-hmm. which is, again, in banks doesn't exist, right? In mm-hmm. banks, mm-hmm. When you want to start a new business, then you talk to 5-10 departments, stakeholders, you make sure everyone buys in, then you get project all rounded up, and once it's ready, then you go for it. In startups, you don't have those means. So what you do is you try something, and you make sure that when you fail, it's a small failure.
Mm-hmm. Fail often, fail fast, and fail cheap.
Exactly. So that was a really, really interesting learning curve for me. And I have to say, I really enjoy sort of this new mentality. It's kind of liberating, and it's also very exciting being able to build something like this.
Thank you so much for sharing that, Tamás. Thank you so much for your time today. It's been a fascinating conversation, and I hope we can have you in the show again in the future.
With pleasure, and thank you very much for having me.
Excellent. Well, thanks everybody, and see you on the next episode.